Within living memory of Alexander the Great, a vast, powerful, and extraordinary empire rose up in northern India. Forged by the strength, intelligence, and philosophy of one man, who in one lifetime went from warlord to monk, from outcast to emperor. His ideas brought a new religion, Buddhism, to full bloom in faraway places, and he's still commemorated in the flag of India. The empire of Ashoka the Great left a mark on all of southern Asia. H.G. Wells, in his famous Outline of History, wrote about this man. Amidst the tens of thousands of names of monarchs that crowd the columns of history, their majesties and graciousnesses and serenities and royal highnesses and the like, the name of Ashoka shines and shines, almost alone, a star. Now that's high praise for someone who many people in the world probably don't know as much about as they do, for example, Alexander or Augustus or Charlemagne or any of those great rulers. And Ashoka was probably the most important Mauryan emperor of India at a time roughly 100 or so years after Alexander. So in a period of history where, you know, that part of the world was developing maybe faster than some parts of the Western world, and certainly there were belief systems starting to come into play that have been influential throughout history from that point onward. His name was Ashoka the Great. That's what they call him. And certainly someone who I was very, very pleased to discover had an incredible story.
Yeah, and that's what I love so much about history. I think it was in the mid-1800s, that they started finding out about Ashoka, because previous to this, there was nothing really told about him. And he controlled swathes of territory.
Huge territory.
From modern-day Iran and the whole Indian subcontinent.
And probably one of the things that makes this guy so compelling, and I do agree with you that this is the best thing about history, is you know, we've talked about so many people in every episode of this series from the first one. But when you discover someone new, or you discover someone whose name you might have heard in passing, but you actually get into their story, what's amazing about this guy is this incredible balance between pacifism and war, and the fact that he was both this incredible warrior and this great conqueror and this powerful, mighty emperor, and also this pacifist, this holy man, this converter, this person who brought a new way of thinking at a time where really life was pretty miserable and violent for most people on planet Earth.
Yeah, it was very violent. And if you had to think the amount of people that he converted is maybe a strong word, but on the Buddhist side, to bring that across to a whole massive nation, or a whole lot of different smaller nations together.
Well, we'll talk about the spread of Buddhism a little bit later, but let's just start at the beginning of his story. He wasn't the eldest son of the Emperor Bindusara, but he was, I think, the second or the third son. And, you know, his elder brother was set to inherit things, but his father sent him at a young age to go and quell a rebellion. And off he went. Expectations were not high. The rebellion was quite strong. And he just took them down. And this was in his teens, maybe his early 20s. And he just emerged as this guy who had a knack for military maneuvers, for training, for sophisticated deployment of, you know, the right kind of infantry and the right sort of fighting men and elephants and all the rest of it. And remember, this is only, as I said earlier, within living memory of Alexander.
Yeah.
When, you know, he had already disrupted that part of the subcontinent by his fights at the Hydaspes River and all the rest of it with Porus. So Alexander's enemy at the Battle of the Hydaspes was Porus, Emperor Porus, or the what was he? He was kind of a mid-sized ruler in that area. But when Alexander had come in there and disrupted things, that was where that whole northwestern area of India was changed forever.
And it's so interesting, as we talk at Ashoka's court, there were Greeks still in the Ashoka's court. That for
amazing,
me, just,
right?
You know, there's a guy coming from Macedonia and you've got Greeks now in India, but that's a separate story. When he was sent—
The one guy was called Iona, which they think might have been Iona, Ionia, which could have been the area he was from in Greece, or that was his Greek name. And it was converted by the Indians to be Yona.
To be called
Yona. Huh? Yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah, but his dad sent him to quell this rebellion. And I think the big strong point that came out of this is that he was a great leader of men, because there was not a lot of bloodshed, and they came across to him and they believed in him. That really was a big part of his skill that he did throughout his 36 years as he reigned the Mauryan Empire.
Mm.
But that was one of the things that happened when he went there. And you know, it's hard to say if he was set up to fail, but it was an extremely difficult task that he had to do at the age of 18.
Yeah, absolutely. Nonetheless, he already was developing a pretty big reputation. He also had a bit of a rough skin. You know, he was regarded as being not particularly worthy as a successor. His elder brother was definitely the preferred one. But he decided after his father's death that he was going to take on his brother. And he soundly defeated him. It didn't take very long for him to prove that he was the guy.
Yeah, and he threw his brother into a pit. Today it might seem a little bit over the top, but I think 2,000 years ago, it was par for the course.
Yeah, Susima was the eldest brother.
Yeah. So there was talk of that his dad had 100 sons, but they're saying more than likely there's four, and he wasn't the oldest, and Susima was the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, he had the other two brothers killed as well, which is what you did. You just wanted to eliminate any.
You didn't take any chances.
No, you didn't take any chances. And he had to. I mean, you had to lead, you know. If you look at lions, I mean, the male lions will always kill the closest competitors.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, both Sri Lankan and North Indian traditions say that he was a very violent man before he encountered Buddhism. But he fell in love with a girl called Devi. And Devi was a Buddhist. In fact, she came from the same clan as Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. And no doubt she was the one who first gave him insight into Buddhism, into pacifism, into the ideas that are prolific even today in Buddhism. And they say that after that, he was a completely changed person.
But often, I think why they said he was massively cruel and a despot, actually, was to show the massive difference, the aha moment.
Right.
Wanted that to be.
So you think a little bit of it might have been made up?
Yeah, so he might have been quite, you know, he might have been a collaborative type of leader. Yeah, we don't know.
Say killing three of your brothers, it seems to indicate to me a bit violent.
Yeah, possibly, yes. Fair enough.
Yeah. And he also used to do funny things, like he would test the loyalty of his commanders and ministers by giving them orders to cut down every flower and fruit-bearing tree in a specific area. And when they failed to carry it out, then he would cut off the heads of up to 500 people. Now, again, this may be exaggerated. There's the story of one day during a stroll in a park, he and his concubines came across a beautiful tree, and the sight put him in a really sensual mood, and the women did not enjoy caressing his famous rough skin. Sometime later, when he fell asleep, the resentful women chopped the flowers and the branches of his namesake tree. After he woke up, he burnt 500 of his concubines to death as a punishment. Again, this number 500 sounds a bit exaggerated.
But I think even 50 would be quite tough.
I didn't know he had that many concubines, but the guy was busy. Anyway, he did eventually fall in love with this girl called Devi. This was his most important relationship. And he obviously had famous children with her, which we'll get to in a moment or two. But he decided at that point that this idea, this Buddhist tradition, was something he was quite interested in. And part of what makes him such a central pillar in the story of Buddhism is that he was the first one to actually send emissaries all over India. He visited, famously, the four major sites of Siddhartha Gautama's life, the place where he reached enlightenment, the place where he was born, the place where he died. And he was clearly a convert from that point on. Mm. I mean, he would go around and talk to anyone who wanted to know about the story of Buddhism, about his own story, about how they shouldn't war with each other, how you shouldn't hurt anybody or anything.
And these spread the word with, I suppose you would call them missionaries of sorts, out to China and Sri Lanka.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And Thailand at the time.
And he would obviously eat only certain things. He established shrines all over the place, and he adopted the idea that tolerance was also massively important. So he never forced anyone to convert to Buddhism. He allowed people to practice their own religions, and in very many places they continued to. You know, at that point, Hinduism and Jainism were the two other major religions.
And I think, yeah, that Hinduism probably was the major, and I think Buddhism was quite small at the time.
It was. And he actually managed to get Buddhism not only to be accepted in Sri Lanka, but to become the majority religion in Sri Lanka, which it remains to this day. I didn't know that, but this is back in 200 BC,
yeah, so it's,
and you know, Sri Lanka is still affected by this.
Affected by what he, it's incredible.
It's amazing.
But according to the stories and according to the legend, but also they wrote stories on pillars, etc., because that's where they got most of his information from.
That's right, these beautiful columns that they built, and they had these lion heads on them. They were sort of, it was the capital of the column, the top of the column was beautifully sculpted in a way that, I mean, you know, we talk about classical architecture. This was Indian classical architecture at its very best.
But on there, they described there's an area called Kalinga.
Yes.
And that area was extremely important from a trading perspective. And they weren't warring, there wasn't anything going on, but he felt that, you know, he's going to conquer this area. And they went in. It was extremely difficult. There was massive losses on both sides, but there was slaughter of 100,000 inhabitants. There were over 150,000 more that were taken hostage, and also thousands were left to die and from disease and famine. Legend says, you know, he walked through the desolate at
the battlefield
where all these inhabitants were lying dead, and it just knocked him properly. And maybe as you'd mentioned a bit earlier, you know, with Devi and the underlying, all the scriptures that he actually learned and was feeling, it just all boiled to the top. And that was the big turning point for him.
That was his aha moment.
That was his Damascene
conversion. Now, I just want to quickly go back to the lion capital, because there are a couple of symbols there that are still hugely important in India, even today. If you look at it, the lions are obviously a major part of this, but there's also the wheel, which is still on the flag of India, even to this day. And that wheel is called the Wheel of Moral Law, or the Dharma Chakra, which is part of what Indians still regard today as one of their foundational symbols. And I think that's really interesting, because it comes from a time long before, you know, Gandhi and Nehru had decided to put it on the flag. But they obviously went back into history to find the original identity of this incredible emperor and all of the succession that he produced.
And if you look through the history of India, I mean, he really stands out massively as somebody that, you know, to be able to lead such a massive empire passively.
Yeah.
It's just testimony to the leadership skills he had.
Yeah.
And his deep belief in what he...
I mean, this is not a time where you could get away with a philosophy of pacifism. There were a lot of people who would have immediately seen that as weakness and taken the chance of overthrowing you.
Yeah.
And he had luckily in the beginning of his career as a warlord managed to kind of quell a lot of that.
So you had respect in that side already.
He had respect, yeah. And I think it's unfortunate that there wasn't a whole lot of success in his progeny. You know, usually when you get these great emperors, the very next generation is usually a bit of a dud. And that's absolutely true, because
sadly, that is. They say around 50 years or more, it had fallen apart.
Yeah. So he died in his 37th year as emperor, and that's around 232 BCE. They think he got ill. He started using state funds to make donations to the Buddhist cause. His ministers eventually denied him access to the treasury. He started donating his personal possessions. And on his deathbed, his only possession that he had left was the half of a fruit, which he offered as his final donation to the Sangha. And such legends have encouraged ever since Buddhists to make generous donations in their last days, which is something that he started the tradition of as well.
But Gareth, the children, you mentioned a little bit earlier about the children that he had with Devi and what they did. So what happened to them post his death?
Well, some of them went on. Obviously, there were huge fights, because there was a queen who was called Tisaraka, who was the last one. And she apparently was was very much trying to install herself. And she was really the mistress in the beginning. But his own children kind of disappear into history. We're not really aware of their contribution from that point on, because there was a massive amount of faction fighting between the children. Mm. And it didn't appear that there was any massive success for any of them post his death.
I think that the one settled in Sri Lanka, I think there could have been longevity in terms of what he believed in. And he
his line.
Made quite a statement in that area. I think it was called Ceylon a few hundred years ago.
Yeah, that's correct. Ceylon. That's what I think the English called it, Ceylon, and then it was renamed back to Sri Lanka. But he had plenty of queens. There was obviously the first one, which was Devi. Then there was Karuvaki. Then there was Padmavati. And then this Tisaraka that I told you about now. But Karuvaki is the only queen who was known from his actual inscriptions, in other words, contemporaneous sources. And she is mentioned in a pillar in a place called Allahabad. And the inscription names her as the mother of a prince called Tivara. And apparently, according to one theory, she was the last surviving queen. And her progeny were the ones who mostly inherited the bits and pieces of the empire that could keep together. By the way, they also say that when he died, his body, which was cremated, burnt for 7 days and seven nights.
Oh, that's impressive.
Well, either that or it wasn't a very good fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, his sons, there were a couple of those. Mahinda is the one you're talking about who went to Sri Lanka. Then there were a bunch of others who were much less well-known. Some of the sons had sons, but none of them are really mentioned in the inscriptions around the time that he lived. So a lot of them were written much, much longer, much, much further down the way. So you could say a bit of hearsay, not entirely clear, but there was no direct line of succession.
Yeah, and I think, like I said in the beginning, it was 1837 that an English gentleman by the name of Princep that really started unpacking this and realizing who is this great leader.
Mm.
And more information came out that was the only empire builder of the ancient world who at the heart of his power went into this passive, a mutual understanding and harmonious relationships with the countries around him or they weren't called countries.
And the religions
at the time,
around
and
him.
The religions around
and,
him.
And famously, he also had all these rock inscriptions made, which kind of told the story of his reign and of Buddhism and of why it all mattered and what philosophies he embodied. But it was very much in his style of speech. So it almost feels to people, most people couldn't read in India. So the priestly class or the warrior class would have to read these things to people. And they would read them as if they were Ashoka. And that won a lot of people over. They were convinced that this was the best way certainly from a PR point of view, it was a real win. Because people thought this guy has, the best possible ancient world PR machine working for him with these rock inscriptions.
Agreed. But like you said, he had to build his reputation first before switching, and his children never had that.
Right.
So I think that was maybe one of the reasons for the end of the Mauryan Empire 50 years later.
Yeah, it all ended, but the legacy lives on in architecture. I mentioned the stone architecture that really began during his reign. And the palaces that were built mostly out of stone then, up to then, a lot of these places were not built in any permanent materials. So there's a huge legacy in the architecture. There's a legacy in symbols like the wheel that I mentioned earlier on, inscriptions that are still written all over the place, and coins, interestingly enough. A bunch of coins which are shaped almost like squares with two of the four edges leveled off. So almost like a tombstone shape, you would call it. And there were silver coins. There were punch-marked coins. And these were considered currency for trading, which was quite new in that part of the world at that time.
And the information that we get it's incredible that the stories that you'd pulled out of it, because literally 2,200 years ago, whatever it was, it's so difficult to know exactly what was going on then. We just have so little information.
And there have been lots and lots of Bollywood productions in the last 20 years about Ashoka the Great, which all have a little bit of truth and a little bit of mythology in them and plenty of dancing.
Of course, 100%.
Ashoka the Great. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History. Every episode is available on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. In the next episode...
At the age of 12, he went off to his mom's cousin, and this is where he was educated in the art of war and a lot of different things. He must have impressed somebody, because then he was knighted in 1166, and this really set him on his way.